Andrew Phelps. I was born in December 1901. And I grew up in St. Mary's Township, Waseca County. Lived in the county all my life. I got started on the railroad through a friend of mine. My first pay trip was made October 29th, 1919. And I feel that I have shoveled a lot of coal since then. And when I enter the next world, I won't have that job.
Hopefully.
There was no railroad man in my immediate family. However, my grandfather, Seth S. Phelps, who came in from Wisconsin, bought land west of Waseca. He did not homestead. He bought a couple sections of land. The railroad hadn't come through yet, but was building someplace between Rochester and Owatonna when he came in. And he farmed 2 miles west of Waseca, where the big brick and Kasota stone house stands. When the house was built, they put in a spur and spotted cars on the spur.
Can you explain what a spur is? For people that wouldn't understand, a spur?
They call it a spur.
What was that?
Well, it's just a little stub track with a switch off from the main line.
Okay.
Now, a switch is, has that been explained any time?
Yeah.
Well, you know what a switch is. And the brick and stone were hauled with horses from this spur to where the house stands now. And the family consisted of 4 boys and 2 girls, 3 girls. My grandfather contracted with the old Winona and St. Peter when they first went through to furnish wood that was burned in the engines. And he had a couple of fueling stations between Waseca and Kasota, just this side of St. Peter. I think it was 3 altogether. And it was customary when they needed wood, they'd pull up to these stations, which was a platform alongside the track, and a man in charge of the fueling station would throw on whatever wood they needed, 1 cord, 2 cord, or whatever they needed. And the engineer would give him a piece of paper telling how many cord of wood he got. And on, at different times, these slips of paper were turned in for money. And he furnished wood for the Winona and St. Peter on this area until they started burning coal. When they started burning coal, well, he was out of luck. And the story goes that he lost quite a little money because he made a power saw to cut the wood, which done away with some of the labor. And that was a total loss to him. Then in the spring of 1884, on the 11th of March, he was coming home from Waseca with a team of horses, and it was quite a bad snowstorm and had a bad winter. There was a lot of snow. And the crossing west of town, instead of driving directly across the crossing, they came to the track and then drove down the track a ways through the snowbank and then out. And he was in this bank west of Waseca when a light engine struck him and killed him. That was March 11th, 1884. And my grandmother continued operating the farm. And after that, with the help of the boys, one of them being my father. My father's name was George. And his younger brother's name was Joseph. And the other boys died with diphtheria when they were small. I have a picture here with me showing the old Oconto, number 4, with a picture of my grandfather in the gangway of the engine. I can't tell you what date it was taken or who the other different men are on the picture, but to authenticate my grandfather being there, I took this picture to Emmon Smith, who operated a hotel here in Waseca years ago and served as water boy on the building of the Winona and St. Peter. And he said that was my grandfather. And of course, my uncle that gave me the picture also told me that.
Is that sort of how you got into railroad then? Was because of your grandfather?
Well, how I got into railroading was through the kind of the coaxing and efforts of a friend of mine who started on the road. He was a brakeman, and I couldn't go on braking at that time because they didn't need brakemen, but they needed firemen. So I started out as a fireman.
What year was that?
In October 29th, 1919. And I held my rights until I retired May 31st, 1967. Of course, there were some years during the Depression that I was laid off, and I didn't have a continuous service because of that. That was when bigger power came and smaller engines were scrapped and done away with. This picture here is considered a small engine, but at the time
Oconto,
it was quite modern.
The Oconto was considered
yeah.
small? As a fireman, what did you have to do?
Well, as a fireman, my duties were to shovel coal into the firebox. It was a firebox. As the coal burned, it created heat in the boiler and boiled the water. And as the water boiled, the steam rose to the top. And this part up here is known as the steam dome. And there's a valve up in the very top that lets steam out from there down into the cylinders that operates the engine. Now, the reason for that is the higher up you can get above the water, the drier the steam is. And if you get water with the steam, like in poor water areas, why, it washes your lubrication off in the cylinders and you're just in trouble. And the fireman also has charge of the left side of the engine. When you are switching, he watches and takes signals and watches crossings and so on. It's his side of the engine. And I may mention too that in the cab there's a rope that goes out to the bell. While the bell works automatically by air, at times when it fails, it's up to the fireman to pull the rope and start the bell. And this rope crosses across the cab to the engineer. He can still pull it over there if he wants to. The same way with the whistle cord. Fireman can blow the whistle. You notice the big stack on the top of the smoke stack? all of the early engines were that way. That was because of wood burning. A lot of times there were sparks that went through the boiler and went on up, and if it had been small, it would have blown them higher, and it would probably drifted more apt to cause damage. All of the early trains, especially the extra trains.
The extra trains.
Extra train. Well, that's a train that operates not on a schedule. A scheduled train is a train that operates on a certain time schedule with a recorded. And it always has a certain time at the same station every time. Then an extra train is one that's made up and just runs extra.
Why would they be using that if there was more passengers going somewhere?
For this reason, they maybe have more business come in right now than they could handle on their regular trains. And another way they could have done that, they could have run their regular train by sections, like first section and second section, third section. I've operated on out of Tracy on stock trains years ago where you run the third and fourth section of number 482. Number 482 is a scheduled train. And as the third or fourth section, well, you were the third or fourth train by that number. But most always they run extras. And when they run extras, instead of using the engine number as they did in later years, they use the conductor's name. As an example, if you had two conductors, Coppersmith and Jones, and they were going to meet at Casson, the order would read, Coppersmith, meet conductor Jones at Casson. That was the way the orders read, and then they would follow that. But in later years, why, the extra trains always went by the engine number, the lead engine. It was extra so-and-so. And those train orders there that you have of that Kefauver special, you will notice extra passenger number so-and-so. That was the number of the engine. It didn't say the conductor's name.
Talk a little bit about what a typical run was like in the earlier days when you were on?
The run consisted of usually a division point was around 100 miles. And they figured freight service 12 and a half miles an hour, that'd be 8 hours to make the 100 miles. And in that 8 hours included your preparatory time and your tie-up time. Now, your preparatory time was from the time you went down to get the engine and the train crew, brakemen, went down to couple up the air hoses between the cars and tie your brakes and then leave. And if you were longer than figured 12 and a half miles an hour, why, it run into overtime. That is the basis of your pay. Anything over 8 hours or your miles was over 100, why, it was figured on a time basis. And
the tie-up time?
Passenger was figured at 20 miles an hour. And the passenger day was considered as 5 hours or 20 miles, might be 100 miles. And then the pay was based on either miles or hours, whichever way you wanted to figure. And I might mention, too, that in the early days, when the Winona and St. Peter first went through here, they didn't pay by check like they do today. They had a pay car, what they called a pay car. It was a passenger coach, and then in this passenger coach was the paymaster that had money, hard money, to pay the different men. And He had their names and how much they had coming, and he would pay them. And we ought to remember, too, that in the early day, there wasn't too much paper money used. There was an awful lot of gold that was used, gold coins. And many times they were paid in gold along with some silver. I have in my collection at home my grandfather's pay box, but it's empty. There was no money in it when I got it. But it's divided off into petitions and a tray, and he used that as paying. And in my numismatic collection, I have a token from an Eastern Railroad, good for one half cord for a certain engine, cordwood. I mentioned that when the man put wood on the engine, the engineer gave him a slip of paper. But these Eastern railroads, they paid with these tokens. And they're quite rare today. And all it said on the token was either half cord, one cord, or cord and a half, and then the engine number. The fellow would turn these tokens in and get their money. And then they would, in turn, give the tokens back to the engineers again that they could use them over. Whereas paper script, about once is all they could use it. It would get crinkled and...
Did you find yourself out on the train for days at a time, or were you home?
Oh, yes. Your run on the railroad usually consisted of 2 days, one day going and one day coming back, and you were stayed at the other end overnight. So approximately half of your life on the railroad was spent away from home if you were working daily. We had a nice place at Winona to stay. It was known as the West End Hotel. And compared with prices nowadays, it'd be hard to believe. We had meals, we could get meals there for 50 cents and a bed was 35 cents. And they were good meals and we had a nice bed.
And was that sort of a railroad hotel?
That's right, it was railroad, all railroad, man.
Oh, it was.
And there was somebody getting up and going to work or somebody going to bed at all hours of the day, morning and night.
What did you do in your spare time there?
Well, there wasn't too much spare time if you were on some of those heavy jobs, because usually you'd go down and you'd get your rest and come back.
Yeah.
And I often thought, in arriving at Tracy or Winona at the end of the run, that when you got to bed, you get something to eat and get to bed, well, you'd stay there until the call boy came. And then you'd get up and get something to eat and go right to work.
They would hire someone to keep everybody on schedule?
Oh, sure. They had a call boy on around the clock, and he worked in conjunction with the operators at the depot through the train dispatcher when they'd order.
Would these hotels be private enterprises, or were they operated by the railroad?
Oh, they were all railroad men, all working for the railroad company.
And the owners of the hotel, were they?
No, that was a private,
private
building. And the business. And then we had a rooming house in Tracy. She just had rooms. And then we eat at the restaurants. And there were all night restaurants, and most always somebody in there getting up or going or coming. When I was growing up at home on the farm, we always had lunches in the forenoon. Middle of forenoon, middle of the afternoon. And when I went to work on the railroad, we didn't have any lunches. And I learned to eat when I could get a meal and always have plenty to eat. And even to this day, I follow that habit pretty much. I like a good breakfast and a lunch at noon and then a good supper. But,
How did your wife like that type of life, do you think?
Well, the type of life was interesting, although it was hard. It was hard labor. And there were times when the engine didn't steam good, or you maybe have bad coal, and you would be in trouble, or it'd be extra work. And there was a lot of difference in the engineers, how they run the engine. If they didn't like you, why, they could run the engine a little bit tougher and make you burn more coal. And
did that happen?
Oh, definitely. And but we here where I worked, I think we had as good a bunch of men to work with as any place that I know of.
How long were you a fireman then?
Well, as I don't think I mentioned, but in the late 20s. And during the 20s, we got bigger power, bigger engines, and they hauled more cars. There were less trains, and a couple of the branches were pulled off. So my promotion was rather slow. I wasn't promoted quick like a lot of men were. I went to work in October 1919. And I didn't do any running to speak of as an engineer until the late 30s, early 40s, where many of the older men probably fired 3, 4, 5 years and then got a job running.
The Depression was in there too.
That's right. And in later years, they've done away with the men. It used to be 5 men to a crew, and now there's 3 men to a crew. In 1920, when the seniority list first came out, I was number 114 on the fireman's list. And there were that many engineers on the engineers list, which would be approximately 225 to 50 men. And nowadays, in engine service, there's only about 25 on the same territory, just 25 men, not 25 firemen or 25 engines, just 25 men. And of course, that's because of the bigger power coming, and the branches have done away with a lot of the branch work. It was interesting when the diesels came. A diesel, you may think a fireman didn't have anything to do on a diesel. It's true, he didn't shovel coal, but he had a lot of things to watch. And there was an old saying when the diesels came that when you encountered trouble on a diesel, it would take you 2 hours to locate your trouble and 5 minutes to fix it. Whereas on a steam engine, when you had trouble, it would take you 5 minutes to find your trouble and 2 hours to fix it. And another thing with diesels, when they came, they were coupled together, and one engineer and one fireman operated any number of units, like 2, 3 all coupled together, and they all operate from one control stand. Whereas years ago with a steam engine, when they run a double header, why, there had to be an engine crew on both engines. I have a picture here of the wreckage of the 2 passenger trains, 516 and 517, that had a head-on collision between Lamberton and Sanborn on April 29th, 1920. At the time, I was working as a fireman out of Huron, South Dakota, and I got my release that same day, and I intended to go home, and I would have been on train 5:16. But I had a bad cold, and the lady of the house where I had a room, she talked me into staying. So I stayed over that night. She came up to the room the next morning and told me about the two trains that run together. Otherwise, I would have been right in a smoker where three people were killed. There was five people killed in this wreck. Engineer and fireman on train 5:16, and a conductor and two passengers.
Why would something like that have happened?
Well, here's the way it happened. These two passenger trains used to meet regularly at Lamberton or Sanborn or any one of those towns close by. And this particular night of the wreck, they were to meet at Sanborn, was the first order. So both trains got the order to meet at Sanborn. Then the train dispatcher changed the meet order to Lamberton instead of Sanborn. The westbound train got the order, but the eastbound train didn't get the order. In other words, the operator was at fault and the train dispatcher because of the mix-up in the orders. So the westbound train, 5:17, was going to meet 5:16 at Lamberton, and 5:16 eastbound train was going to meet 5:17 at Sanborn, and they met approximately halfway. And they met on a curve in the country. And I knew the engineer, and well, I knew both engineers and both firemen. But the fireman on the westbound train happened to notice them and notice the light of the train. It was at night. And he called the engineer's attention to it, and they set the emergency brake and jumped. And when the engines hit, the fireman was at the head end of the mail car, which was just a short distance from the steps. And the fireman on the eastbound train had jumped, but he didn't jump quick enough. He was under the tank. They found him under the tank. In other words, he got off and then the tank tipped over on him. But the other fellow with the brake set, why, they hurt themselves on the jump, but then they saved their lives. And there was 26 cars of scrap iron. And these couple pictures here of it that I have in my hand here shows the wheels and scrap iron and everything, how they were all piled up.
Do you know of any other train wrecks in this area that you can remember?
I was on an engine that tipped over one time. I wasn't on the engine that tipped, but we were switching at Volge, South Dakota. That's the first station west of Brookings. And we were backing up. We had a hold of five or six cars, and we were backing up on the sidetrack. And one of the tires on one of the wheels had slipped and was out of line. And when the wheel passed over the frog, instead of going directly over the frog and following the rail, it pulled it on the ground.
Can you explain what a frog is?
A frog is where one rail crosses the other. That's a frog, and then part of the switch is just the switch point. But when it passed over the frog, because of the tire being slipped and twisted on the wheel, it didn't follow the rail, and it pulled it on the ground. And when it went on the ground, being in the spring of the year when it was soft, it broke through the ties, and as the gangway widened, and I could feel that, and I jumped because I knew the engine was going to tip or anything. I knew there was something wrong. So I just jumped out the window on my side, and I started to run back to get away from the engine. And when I turned around, the engineer was right back of me. He did the same thing. And it backed up a little ways until they cut through the ties, and then the engine tipped over on its side. But we weren't in it. Contacted the train dispatcher and told him that he wouldn't leave Sleepy Eye until the dispatcher gave him a clear main line all the way to Tracy. He didn't want to meet anybody because he couldn't tell where we were. And the dispatcher gave him that, and then we went. And it was a bad, very bad storm. There was a lot of snow, and we hit a lot of snow.
Did you have to get out and shovel it those times, or it would always get through there?
No, I never had to do that, but I was stuck on a snowplow out in Dakota one time. I transferred out there, and they had a lot of snow, and we got out and got stuck in the snow. We couldn't back up, we couldn't go ahead. And we stayed there. Section men shoveled snow in the tank, and we melted it from heat from the steam. And we had a couple farmers haul out some coal for us. And we were there 2 days in a snowstorm, snowbank. Okoboji Cut, south of Gettysburg, out in Dakota. And then I was worked on a rotary snowplow at one time. And if I never went back to work on a rotary again, it would be too soon.
Why is that?
Well, they had an old boiler. It was an old locomotive boiler rebuilt into a rotary snowplow. And the water wasn't very good, and we had poor coal. And when they got in the snow, it was real bad. The engineer, he just widened on the throttle, and I couldn't boil water fast enough for him. So,
when you said that water wasn't good,
there's a lot of difference in water. We had poor water out there in Dakota. Now, poor water is alkali water. And the best water you can get for a boiler is pure soft water. There's not minerals and stuff in it. And there were a lot of places where we had bad water and we had trouble. But in later years, they developed chemicals, compounds that they used in the water to offset that. So it wasn't so bad.
So if you had poor water, the engine's performance would be...
Oh, sure, it would be much better. Because... all of the water would go into steam, and it would leave the boiler clean. It wouldn't be burning or using melted snow. There was a lot of dirt that'd get in it, and we had to blow down the boiler quite often to get that sludge out of it. They call that the blow-off cup. Open that, and that's down right down on the very bottom. I don't know whether they got one on there, but it's... Here's the boiler part here. This would be about in here.
Right below
right in the very bottom, because that's where your sediment and everything goes.
This is right below where the engineer sits.
That's right. That's right. Boy, these are interesting pictures. I can place a lot of them.
Now that one, I've never understood. It's a picture of a bird on something.
I don't know what that is.
On the back it says, this robin may be 4.5 inches deep. I can't figure that one out.
Yeah, that's...
Did Waseca have a hotel for the railroad men too?
Well, it wasn't considered a railroad hotel because most everybody lived here. But the old hotels where different fellas stayed that didn't live here was one of them stands down there now, and then the other one burned up here where Ben Franklin store is.
What were the names of those?
Well, that one that burned where Ben Franklin, it was called the Grant House. And the other one down there is called, I believe, the Waverly Hotel. That was Emmon Smith running that. He was the one that told me that...
Right. Why was it that most of the people lived in Waseca? Because it was...
Well, it just happened that way, that this was a division point. See, the board was operated here. You hired the men here, and the seniority list was...
So this was a regular railroad
That's
town?
That's right. It was a railroad town. Then they had a rip track out here in the yard where they repaired cars. There was a lot of men worked here. There must have been at least 400 or 500 men working here at one time.
Was that sort of the major job in Waseca for?
Well, sure.
What
sure.
Years would that have been?
Well, that was railroad work. Was the only industry we had here. See, Johnson's weren't here, Brown's weren't here.
What years was that? Are you thinking?
Well, that was up to, I'd say in the mid-20s, when it began to peter out, when big power got here. Then they didn't do any repairing work on the cars. They did that all at Winona. Well, they had quite a crew here working, they call them, on the rip track, car repairs.
So railroading then, in those years, was a pretty respectable, high-status position.
Gee, you could do pretty near anything here in Waseca if you worked on the railroad, because, you was a railroad man, and you got 2 checks a month, and and if you kept your nose clean and kept going, why,
sure.
You wouldn't, and there wasn't anybody that would doubt you.
What do you see as some of the biggest changes in railroading, especially for this county?
Well, I have noticed more the attitude of the men, and there is a change, rather than physical change on the road. That's pretty much the same as it was then. But your attitude of the men, including the officials. It used to be the officials of the railroad, they picked men that had worked here, had learned the trade and knew the physical characteristics of the road, and then they promoted them. And the attitude of the company was different than it is now. The attitude then was to serve the public, give them good service. Gee whiz, when you get a bad snowstorm in the winter, they did everything they could to get the track open so they could run the trains to give them the service. Now they just let them sit. don't open them till the storm quits.
What?
And the attitude of the individual. Today, an employee, even an engine service, about all he is another number up on the wall. Whereas years ago he was a part of the industry. And speaking about railroading, any line and on connected with the railroad is so much different than any other business whatsoever. Any other business of any kind, you can, when Saturday night comes or Friday night, you can stop and leave it set and then come back Monday morning. But on the railroad, you can't do that. It's continuous. You have to keep it moving. And the feeling of the men between them are so dependent one on the other, more so than any place else. If you work for Johnson's or Brown's printing out here, if you have trouble there with some of those machines in there, you get somebody and they fix it. If you can't operate it, you get somebody else. But on a railroad, when you're put out on these jobs, you are it. You're responsible for that. You have to do it. And you're so dependent on the next fellow. One engineer, if he goes out tonight and he gets orders, he's depending on the other fellow too to follow the rules and the orders. Because if you don't, you're going to be in a wreck like this one wreck was. And even if you're on the section, man, when you go to work in the morning, you get the section boss gets a lineup from the operator when they're going to run any extra trains or how the trains are. And the section man, he depends on the engineer. When they're in a bad place and he can't see, he blows the whistle, let him know where he's at. And the engineer, he's dependent on the section man to keep the track up. Everybody is so dependent on everybody else.
Is that part still the same, do you think?
Well, not so much. The dependence is there, but the people, the employees, don't take it like they used to. Now, your officials today, they'll pick out somebody, maybe work for a week or 2 weeks, and they'll take him down to Chicago and put him through college. 2 weeks college, brainwash him. Tell him what they want done and how they want it done, and then tell him home. And he comes back out here and he don't know anything about trains or hills or where they have trouble and snow bothers, but he's out here telling them what to do. I had a train master one time who didn't know, but he couldn't even follow me on the road. He come down to the engine at Winona and wondered when I was going to leave town. I told him I couldn't tell him. Exactly, because we had a couple up and try the air. And then we finally got going and he wanted to know where I was going to meet the passenger train. And I told him I couldn't tell him for sure, it depended on how the train went up the hill. You know, there's a lot of difference in the trains, you know, and then the wind blows and the difference in the engines.
It takes time to learn
and,
that.
And I told him, I says, the way it looks, if everything goes good, we'll meet him at Lewiston. That's at the top of the hill. So we kept going, he didn't say any more, and we got to Lewiston. I checked my watch before I got to Lewiston. I had time to go to Utica, there's beyond Lewiston. So when we was going through Lewiston, I was going right along. He came over to me and he says, "Say," he says, "we just went through Lewiston." He said, "You're going to meet that passenger train here." I said, "I didn't tell you for sure." I says, "I got time enough going over to Utica." And then we got over there and I stopped to clear the depot crossing and the brakeman cut off and then we run out in the country about a mile west, laid down some guns on the track. And then we come back and I left.
Lay down some guns?
Well, they're torpedoes with a spring clamp, and they clamp on the rail. When you run over them with the engine, they explode like a firecracker.
Oh.
And you can hear that in the cab. It's a flagging procedure. And when you hit those torpedoes, they have a proper name of torpedoes, and you must reduce speed to a speed not to exceed 20 miles an hour and have your train under control. And we come back, and I left the brakeman at the switch. And when he got back, I went back and coupled the air up. He says, "What's all this doing?" He says, "What did you go out in the country for?" Well, I said, "There's a passenger train coming. Went out there to put those torpedoes out and flag them, going to put them in the hole. You know, put them in the hole, put them on the sidetrack." Well, he says, "You can't put a passenger train on the sidetrack." Well, I says, "I sure can. They're going to be on there tonight." Train master and official.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he was set out there to do, and that's what he knew. Boy, shucks. I got so I wouldn't even talk to him anymore that night. He didn't know anything. He was only around here a couple of weeks. That was too long. So you see, we all have troubles too.
And you see that as the biggest change in railroad, is the attitude.
That's the way I look at it.
What do you think caused that attitude?
Of the officials and the attitude of the men, too. I think even in industry, they will say the same thing, that there's a difference in the attitude of an individual. You don't take the interest in it that you used to.
Why?
Well, they're more interested in getting their check, getting a big check. That seems to be all it is nowadays. Why, years ago, those old engineers, why, they have an engine of their own, they assigned them engines. And why, they take care of that like you would your baby. You know, see that it was taken care of.
It sounds like, from what you're saying, that it was more of a personal thing then. Now everything's kind of big.
Well, that's what I mean, that it's... That's the way I look at it, what I see. I don't know whether that's good or not.
No.
But as far as getting over the road, and, well, there ain't much difference in that. Of course, the track conditions ain't like it used to be. We used to have good track.
That's declined too?
You see, with these engines, these steam engines here, they were quite rigid, what they call rigid, you know. This frame here, see, they were long, and it was the same frame. And while this is only a four-wheeler, there's a lot of them six and eight wheels, and you had them all in a line here.
Mm-hmm.
And when you went down the track, you had to have good track, or you'd throw it out of line. Nowadays, with the diesels, they have a set of trucks here and a set of trucks here. There's nothing in the middle. It's like a streetcar,
mm-hmm.
which is easier on the track. And when they got them, why, well, they just neglected to keep up the track like they should, and it just got poor. Oh, after I quit, they had cars on the ground sitting all over. And the rails got bent, and they never can get them straight afterwards. There was an old section boss years ago, and they'd come along, be on a passenger train, they'd come over to the engineer and say, "Do you hit any bad spots today?" You know, it'd be low. When you hit one, as you run along, your engine drops down, and then when it hits the good track, it comes up again. So when you're running down, it has a tendency to throw, see?
Mm-hmm.
To throw the track over because of this rigidity part of it. And they just go right out there and fix it. And a lot of engineers would just take and drop a note off when they went by if they were out working. They'd say, back by milepost so-and-so, or Jones's Crossing, a couple hundred feet or so, there was a low spot on the south rail. And then they'd check it and fix it. But in the later years, it got so bad, they just couldn't do that. It wasn't men enough. To give you an idea, take in the 20s, 30s they begin to cut. But in the 20s, there were probably a five-man section crew that had 7 miles of track. And in the summer, he'd hire a couple more men when they put in ties. And they cut weeds and kept track of them. Now, they have about 35 miles with only one man. And then they have extra gangs go along and do the work. So you can see what happens.
Why do you think that happened, the decline there in service and
maintenance? They were pinched. The companies were pinched for revenue because business had dropped off. Trucks were competing with them, buses on the highway. That's one mistake that I think railroad management made. When the trucks begin to come, they should have headed them off. I don't mean the local trucks, anything hauling 100 miles, but these cross-country haulers. That would have made some difference.
Do you think with the energy problem the way it is at the railroad will come back?
Well, they have a problem now too because the oil costs so much more. But I don't know just how that's going to work out. You know, people are so used to having their car and they just think they can't get along without it. That'll be the last thing they'll part with. Whether gasoline is $1 or $2 a gallon. If they got to have it to go to work, they're going to have it. But I think mass transportation, I think they'll have to work something out sometime.
Well, we're getting to the end of the tape, so I'm going to have to cut it off.